Welcome to the rebranded and rejuvenated Passport Play podcast with Jonathan Lord. Today's guest, Ben Strauss, is a contributing writer for the New York Times, who, along with New York Times columnist Joe Nocera, has written a book called Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Hey, Ben, thanks for joining me this morning.
Yeah, of course.
So let's start with this one right here. What has the NCAA ever done to you personally?
I don't think anything personally, but I guess I would, I go back to the story sort of, you know, right at the beginning of how we got into this. Ryan Boatwright was a college basketball player at the University of Connecticut, and he was being investigated by the NCAA, and he was from Aurora, and I was based in Chicago, and there was a lot of confusion about, you know, what he had done and why he was being suspended. And the story was that his family had driven through a snowstorm to South Bend, Indiana, where UConn was going to play Connecticut. And right before tip-off, Connecticut found out that Boatwright was under an investigation, and you know, he collapsed into Jim Calhoun's arms when he found out that he couldn't play. And so there was a lot of confusion about why this was, and I went out to Aurora, where his family was from, and I found his dad, and met him in a Chinese restaurant, you know, off the interstate somewhere. And he poured out this story about how the man making accusations to the NCAA against the family was the mother's ex-boyfriend, a guy who was a convicted felon, no less. And the first accusation was that the mother had taken some money for a plane ticket so she could go on a recruiting visit with her son, which is, you know, so inconsequential, and so it's basic parenting. And this is why she was under investigation, and this is why he couldn't play. And hearing the story and hearing what had happened to this mother, who, by the way, the NCAA sort of, you know, swooped in and you know, overturned her life trying to find out information. They went to her work and they went to her home and, you know, asked her about every check she had ever written. It was really sort of this profound experience that this is how the NCAA operated, and it was sort of a pretty eye-opening moment. And I think it stuck with me throughout the research that we did.
Well, I asked only because your book is a fairly comprehensive takedown of the NCAA, and I was kidding when I asked if the NCAA.
It's a fair question.
I didn't think that you were airing any kind of dirty laundry going back to your days as a you know, intercollegiate curling player, but. I just wasn't sure because there were so many stories, personal touches in your book that make the case against the NCAA feel so real that I kind of wanted to get a sense from you where you were kind of entering into this discussion as a journalist, as a fan, as a former athlete, because I think you can wear several different hats when you look at the NCAA and how they treat their student athletes. So it sounds to me like you were part journalist, but you were also part, you know, human being here responding to a real human story in the case of Ryan Boatwright.
Yeah, I think the more you hear the sort of the different stories and in the book, that they go back for years and years. I think the one that sticks with me the most is the LSU story from the 1980s, and that was Dale Brown's team. He was a basketball coach at LSU.
Yeah.
And he had a player who was diagnosed with cancer, and he you know, had to go home to Missouri to get treatment. You know, and the family was pouring money into his treatment, into his care, and they threw a fundraiser and asked LSU if they would send a couple of the player's best friends to the fundraiser. And the school says, absolutely. The governor of Louisiana even offered the state jet to take these kids to the fundraiser. And Dale Brown says, oh, wait, I got to run this by the NCAA. And the NCAA says, oh, no, that's a violation. You know, you can't be carried to an out-of-state, you know, function. That's against the rules. And so what Dale Brown did is he, you know, draws the blinds in his office, and he gives the kids calls the kids into his office and he gives them an envelope full of cash. And he talks about how here he was doing this, you know, basic kindness, right, fulfilling what essentially was the dying wish of one of his players. He felt like a criminal. He said he felt like there were cameras on him as he was giving them this money. And it was the more you hear stories like that, and there's so many of them, it's hard not to become personally touched, I think, by everything that you hear, and to sort of maintain a veneer of a remove from the story. You hear it so many times that you're involved on an emotional level, I think.
Yeah, to me, it seems like with so many institutions and organizations in this country that are in a position of power, with the NCAA, it seems as if there's very little room for gray, if you know what I mean. Rather than taking things on a case-by-case basis, they have to kind of paint in broad strokes, right? Things are either black or white. And if you were to perhaps look at the margins, so to speak, you would find that there is certainly wiggle room when it comes to these individual cases. But the NCAA cannot operate that way because, well, honestly, they're probably afraid of creating precedent, right? Where, you know, the next time a case like this comes up, they have to say, well, no, we're not going to allow it, but we did the last time. And so I get where they're coming from. It doesn't make it any easier to accept. But I certainly understand why they deal in such direct terms.
Such absolute terms, yeah. And you can go back to the guy who started the modern NCAA. His name was Walter Byers. He was a 29-year-old sports writer when he got hired to go to the national office, and he moved the national office to Kansas. And in the early 50s, he got Kentucky to take a penalty, to basically take a year ban from college basketball because of a point-shaving scandal. And all of a sudden, this gave the NCAA power. The idea that the institution could ban a school had never really happened. And so this is the moment when the NCAA really becomes the NCAA. And for years, he also controlled the TV television money. And so that was sort of these two sources of power he had that built the NCAA sort of in its infancy in the 50s. But this is also a guy, Walter Byers, who his personal hero was J. Edgar Hoover. he used to tap phone lines at the NCAA so he could listen to the calls coming in. He had spies in his office sitting by the windows telling him who was coming to work late. He had rules about how clean the desks in the office had to be. And this is the guy who conceived of the 400-page rule book. And even today, you know, decades later, this is sort of the spirit of the NCAA. This is the guy who built it, and the guy even years later who, the spirit of the place is still found in this guy. And I think that the two things that the NCAA doesn't really have are compassion and common sense. And, you know, when you look at the guy who built it, it makes sense.
He sounds like an incredible charmer. Now I won't be able to help. Now every time I watch a college basketball game or a college football game, I'm just going to be envisioning Leonardo DiCaprio as J. Edgar Hoover playing one of the most influential members of the NCAA.
Yeah, and I think he had a lazy eye, too. And so people tell you conversations about, you know, sitting down, he was, you know, and trying to talk to him, and it was sort of hard to have a conversation with him because you were never quite sure if he was looking at you.
Well, you raised the question, kind of going back to I know the NCAA was first created in the early 20th century, around, well, like 1908 or something like that.
1906. Teddy Roosevelt, because, you know, too many people were dying playing football.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's the original impetus for the NCAA.
Wow, how we've kind of come full circle. Yeah, no, that's actually kind of scary. Here we are over 100 years later, and we're dealing with the same issues. But my point about the start of the NCAA is that the origins for the institution, were they different than how the NCAA operates today? In other words, what is the exact function and purpose of the NCAA when it was first created, and how is that different today?
Well, it was first created because you literally had players dying playing college football, and Teddy Roosevelt brought, you know, some university presidents together, and they created this body to oversee college sports with the express purpose of making football safer. And, you know, through the years, in the first half of the 20th century, went through different iterations, and there were, you know, fights about how to compensate players and, you know, whether they were amateurs or students. And, you know, you had schools back in the early days that paid players. You know, they weren't students. They just brought them in and they paid them, you know, as these mercenaries to compete on their campuses. You had a period where there was something called the Purity Code, where, you know, you tried to do away with paying these players. And then there was something called the Sanity Code. And it sort of... it went through a lot of different iterations before Walter Byers came around in the early 50s and sort of, you know, gave Kentucky that penalty and set the NCAA up. You know, the modern NCAA as we know it today, where the scholarship is really what players get and nothing more. And the rule book is really, you know, really strict and basically these are the rules. What its function is to regulate college sports, and what it does is it puts on a number of championships from Division I to Division II to Division III. All these postseason tournaments that the swimmers and the track and field athletes, you know, have at the end of the season, the NCAA puts those on, and those are great. But the other thing that the NCAA does is it enforces these amateur rules, and as our sort of book lays out, these very arbitrary and very hard to understand rules that have been bent and broken by the NCAA itself to make money off the kids and to keep in place rules on the kids while everybody else makes millions and sometimes billions of dollars now.
Yeah, and I think that is the... That is clearly the grossest abuse right now to many of us is just the amount of money that we see pouring in to the NCAA because of, you know, things like television contracts and merchandising. And for most people, well, I'd say for many people, that is a major, major abuse of the student athlete. The fact that these individuals who are responsible for these dollars are not earning a single dime from these contracts, and it all goes to the conferences and the schools and the NCAA. And so I think that's why so many of us have issues with the institution of the NCAA. But part of me can't help but feel as if, and I'm sure a lot of people feel this way, Ben, part of me can't help but feel that the NCAA is kind of a necessary evil in the sense that if you were to take it away, what would happen in the absence of an NCAA? It would almost turn into this situation where you have this power vacuum, right? Where you have all these entities.
No, absolutely not, because what the various lawsuits have come at the NCAA and said is that you can't set this rule for payment at a national level. And what needs to happen is the conferences need to set their own rules. And so, you know, maybe the Big Ten doesn't want to, you know, pay players at all, but the SEC does, and that's fine. But that makes it not a cartel. That makes it legal, and that the idea that this could be this national rule regulating athlete pay, and this rule book too, regulating every movement by an athlete. How, you know, who can buy him dinner? Who can give him a ride? This can't be set at a national level and apply to every college athlete. I think that the key thing is not necessarily that I would say athletes should be paid, but the lawsuits say not that they have to be paid, just that the NCAA can't set this rule that says they can't be paid at all. And so the power should be at the conference level. It should be, you know, schools should decide how to treat their individual athletes. But that doesn't necessarily leave this power vacuum where, you know, there's no rules and it's the wild, wild west.
Yeah, well, you don't think in the absence of a governing body that there would certainly be a period in college sports history where there would be certainly lots of inequalities, right? Because, I mean, with the system you're talking about where conferences kind of are in charge of their own their own rules. Student athletes wouldn't be compensated equally, right? I mean, depending on which conference you play for, or what sport you play for, it would go a long way towards determining what an athlete receives. And so I can imagine that that would lead to just all sorts of issues when it comes to recruitment and other things that could, that would really plague the process for years to come. It might ultimately end up being cathartic and very good for college sports, but I mean, there would be a long sustained period where it would be kind of like the Wild Wild West.
Well, it already is kind of like the Wild Wild West, though. I mean, you have Jim Harbaugh is flying around the country spending $10,000 a day on a private jet to recruit players. Michigan State isn't doing that. You know, there's no limits on how much money the Texas boosters can funnel into the Texas program. You know, there's already this incredibly wide disparity between how much money, you know, the Texas athletic department has and the athletic department that, you know, Kansas State has. So even within that Power Five, not even to mention the disparity between schools like, you know, LSU and Tulane, you know, when you separate the bigger power schools from, you know, those that aren't in, you know, one of the top five conferences. But there already are all of these disparities that everybody talks about, or that everybody sort of says, well, the sky will fall because there's no rules. There really aren't rules now governing what an athletic department can spend. And so instead of giving the money to players, you get these elaborate palaces, these workout facilities, you know, where Oregon is importing wood from Brazil to build their football facility.
lot of good wood down in Brazil, Ben.
I guess that's where the best wood is.
Yeah.
You have so much money already. It's already silly. But the problem is that the rules, none of the rules apply to the players. All of the rules apply to the players. None of the rules apply to the adults in the system. And so you can have Jim Harbaugh spending $10,000 a day. You can have, football facilities that cost $60, $70 million. You already have these disparities. You already have this incredibly silly stuff going on. And if it's just funneling some of that money to the players, doesn't really change what's already going on.
Yeah, well, this sounds like it would. I mean, if you were to deregulate college athletics, it sounds like it would not be necessarily great for the fan. And I understand that we're talking about, we're mostly dealing with, or you're mostly dealing with in your book, from the perspective of the athlete, the amateur athlete. But for the fan, a deregulated college sports system is not necessarily great because, I mean, well, you could argue that there's not a level playing field to begin with, but with the future that you're kind of describing here, it really wouldn't be a level playing field.
Okay, so, and my co-author Joe has an idea for a salary cap. Right, so it's not deregulated completely, but basically, so that right, if you're worried that it's the whole thing is going to go up in smoke, what you could do is you could give each school $3.5 million. Right, this is less than most of them pay their coaches already.
Wait, hold on. Let me interrupt you though. But there is no NCAA, so how do we decide who's giving out the money? How do we make sure it's just $3.5 million?
No, there is the NCAA.
Oh, there is. Oh.
Still exists.
Oh, I thought we got rid of them. No?
No, we haven't gotten rid of the NCAA. The NCAA can still exist, but, you know, you can negotiate the salary cap with an like a player's entity. You know, it doesn't have to be a union. It just has to be a representative group that agrees to this salary cap. So it's within American law.
I'm sure. Right? I already can tell that this idea will definitely go smoothly.
but just hear me out, right?
Okay.
So you have $3.5 million per school spend on their football and their basketball teams, right? So each guy gets $25,000, and then there's a pool of money that you can use to recruit players and say, you know, Kansas says you're worth $50,000, and, you know, Oklahoma State says you're worth $60,000, and, you know, money becomes a part of the equation in recruiting players. And so then, you know, you don't have to have these coaches you know, acting like clowns trying to, you know, show how much they care about the athlete. They can show them on a piece of paper how much money they're worth. And it streamlines this recruiting process in a way that makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, $3.5 million at a school, you know, at all of these Power Five schools is not going to break the bank because, like I mentioned, you know, this is less than they're paying their coach right now. At just about every one of them. And so there's a way where you could, you know, it wouldn't change the system that much. And when you bring up fans, it's actually interesting. I don't think fans care that much whether or not players should be paid. I don't think they have, I don't think that they, you know, this is some issue that they, you know, feel deep in their souls that athletes shouldn't be paid. What they care about is college football on Saturday afternoons in the fall. They care about being able to watch their favorite team and go tailgate at the alma mater.
But fans
afraid that this might go away. And I get what my point is that sharing some of this money with players is not going to, you know, destroy college sports. Just like free agency didn't destroy baseball. Just like, you know, NBA players in the Olympics didn't destroy the Olympics. This isn't going to necessarily destroy college sports as you know it. And in fact, I think that it wouldn't.
Okay, but fans do want to be entertained. And I get what you're saying, that they want their team to win. But at the same time, there's got to be a part of the fan base that also wants to watch competitive games. And in the absence of a regulatory body like the NCAA, I mean, who knows what you'd have? You could have Alabama beating the piss out of Michigan State even worse than they currently do. And, I mean, who's that good for?
Right. I don't think anybody's advocating for destroying the NCAA and blowing it up.
I thought that was the thesis of your book.
No, it certainly has a role to play. I would say that in setting up, you know, the structure of college sports and making sure the championships run, it would make more sense if the conferences determined compensation. But, you know, in the $3.5 million salary cap world, you know, the NCAA by all means would you know, be a party to that. So I mean, upsets would still happen. There's still, you know, the number of good players isn't going to change. You'd still have players going to, you know, filling rosters at all these different schools, and you know, you'd still get upsets in March Madness, and they'd be even greater, you know, upsets because maybe you'd have unpaid players upsetting paid players, and it would be, you know, it would add even, you know, maybe a more, you know, intriguing level to March Madness. But the disparity between the schools is already so great. I don't think that this is going to escalate it. I just don't.
Okay, let me take on this issue. When I was reading your book, and one of the things I was not aware of, and I think a lot of people will learn if they take the time to read your book, is that healthcare is a serious issue for a lot of these student athletes, in the sense that I always assumed incorrectly, it turns out, that healthcare coverage was issued through the school, so that if you are a player that gets injured while playing for a school, that your healthcare coverage would be covered by a policy through the school. But as it turns out, I was very wrong. And oftentimes, it seems to me, one of the most criminal aspects of the NCAA is that, and these individual schools, is that the kids that play the sports that get hurt, sometimes catastrophically, they're insurance is through private insurance, is through their parents. It is not necessarily through the school. And that's an issue right there that certainly gets me upset when I think about that.
Almost exclusively, the primary policy for college athletes is their parents' policy.
That's just nuts. That's just nuts.
And so now, and this didn't used to be the case, but now schools will offer like a secondary policy. So if there is, you know, a serious issue and your parents' policy doesn't cover all of it, or the school will step in with this supplementary policy, you know, so you don't have any bills. But it's insane because a lot of times, you know, the premiums and costs of your healthcare come back onto your parents' policy.
Like out of network expenses, right? I mean, those are real things.
Just the cost of the policy
will go
up because, right, but that's what I'm saying. The supplemental policy that the school has will cover your out of network. But, you know, for now, and that's while you're an athlete, as soon as you leave school, you're completely on your own.
Right.
Number one. And so good luck, you know, with whatever pre-existing condition you have and, you know, whatever, your whatever rates you have because, you know, you were a college football player. And even, you know, the rates that your family was paying because your insurance was paying for these injuries that you suffered. So their rates are going up. So it's, right, I think a lot of people get caught up on the pay issue, but there's so many other things that need to be fixed about the system, right? Like, we need, like, extended health care once you leave school so you're not paying bills on the injuries you suffered while you're bringing in millions of dollars for your university.
Right, that got me,
lifetime scholarships, because the grand deal here, right, the bargain that's supposed to make this okay is that you're going to, you know, put in the work, you're going to, you know, you're not going to get paid, you're going to make a lot of money for the university, and what you're going to get is an education that's going to set you up for life. Unfortunately, graduation rates for football and men's basketball are at 50%. Just look at what happened in North Carolina, where for 25 years, the school and the athletic department were funneling athletes into fake classes.
Yeah.
And, you know, perhaps the saddest irony is that they were doing it in the African American Studies department. And so you could defend the system a lot better if the education were real. And if, the bargain, the players were getting the bargain that they were promised. But they're also not getting the bargain that they were promised.
Yeah.
And on that front, these scholarships have to be lifetime scholarships because with the amount of time you put in on your sport, with your dreams of becoming a professional basketball or football player, you're just not focused on academics a lot of the time. And you talk to I've talked to so many former players that say, you know, I wish I could go back to school and get the education that I was promised when I can focus on that education instead of a pro career, instead of, you know, putting 60 hours a week in to the football team. And so those, you know, lifetime health care and lifetime scholarships, you know, regardless of where you come down on the pay argument, are two things that you know, should happen tomorrow.
Yeah. A couple of things. You did talk about this in your book. One is that I get sad thinking about all these athletes that say that they would have taken different courses when they were in college if they weren't steered towards these easier focuses because of how hard it is to manage all the time they need to spend with their sport, where you have athletic departments and tutors that literally say you should take these classes because the coursework is manageable and stay away from these classes because it's going to really interfere with the reason you are here, which is to be a part of this team.
And the fact you're here, but you're here to be a part of the team. And what's different about football and basketball players is that not only are you here to be a part of the team, your job is to drive revenue for the school. You're the marketing wing of the school. You bring in, millions of dollars in donations because of the football team. You playing these games, the TV money is flowing. You have a job that nobody else on campus has, and that is, you know, to drive money to your school. And that's why I think, you know, these two sports are so fundamentally different than the other sports on campus.
What about those that say, college athletes do already get paid? They get paid in the form of scholarships and cost of attendance. What do you say?
Yeah,
what do you say to that? What do you say to that argument?
Then you're feeding the argument because not only are you saying that they do get paid, but then you are literally capping their pay at far, far less than market value, and then you're admitting you're signing out. You're signing the piece of paper that says this is a cartel when you say it. Yes, they're paid with this. Then I agree. And now all of a sudden you're admitting that we are a cartel. And yes, we are capping pay at far, far less than market value. And think about this: 95% of these guys don't go pro. Top level football, top level basketball players, they don't go pro. And so what we're doing is we're stealing from them their most marketable years, right, when they could, you know, at the very least sell their name and their image or be in a commercial or sell their autograph. And so many of them are poor, so many of them are black, and we're taking the opportunity. It's un-American when you think about it. We're robbing them of the opportunity to capitalize on the most marketable and most popular they'll ever be.
Is there something, has there been something instituted? I don't think there has, but I did want to talk to you a little bit about the Ed O'Bannon case and also with things like, you know, very, very visible college athletes like a Johnny Manziel. Are there things in place where athletes can have money put aside that was created because of their likeness that they could access later? For some reason, I thought that that was part of the argument that came up in the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, and also it was raised again with Johnny Manziel. Like, wouldn't it? Well, let's just talk about this. Wouldn't it just make sense for if you're not gonna pay these college athletes, the football players and the basketball players, any money? Why not set aside money that is revenue that is created because of their likeness, whether it be jersey sales or video games or things like that they can access when their amateur career, quote unquote, is over? That seems to me like it's fairly practical.
Yeah, and this is what the judge in the Ed O'Bannon case said. The federal judge said the NCAA has broken the rules, the antitrust rules, they've been illegal for decades. And her suggestion was that schools put $5,000 a year into a trust fund for players. So when they graduate, they can access the money, or when their careers are over, they access this money. It's not tons and tons of money, but it's $20,000. It's a nest egg. They've certainly earned it. And on appeal, the appellate judges threw out the trust funds. They said, yes, the NCAA has violated the rules, but we're going to throw out the trust funds. And they basically said that cost of attendance, so a couple of $1,000s in living expenses a year, was all that was enough to remedy the antitrust issues, which is really akin to saying the rules are legal, but we're going to basically leave them in place, which is, you know, on one level, it's really, really hard to wrap your head around.
Well, I think it's pretty clear. I think they're contradicting themselves. And I saw something recently that said that there's a chance, a very likely chance, that this case, the O'Bannon case, reaches, or at least there's a petition in front of the Supreme Court, and that petition, I mean, is a weeks away from being read. Is that correct?
So I think the NCAA, there was a deadline of March 15th to appeal the case to the Supreme Court, and the NCAA has recently asked for an extension, a 30-day extension, I believe, which would lend me to think that they are seriously considering and perhaps likely going to petition the Supreme Court to hear the case. Because right now, what you have on the books is, while practically the NCAA has remained basically unchanged, the rules, the NCAA rules that they have, were number one, have violated the antitrust law for years, and number two, for future cases, should be scrutinized like other businesses. And so it has cracked the door for future cases to come at the NCAA with an antitrust case. And so the NCAA, even though it seems like they have, you know, won the O'Bannon case because not much has changed, they seem to be more likely to appeal this to the Supreme Court. And then, you know, we'll have to see if the Supreme Court would even hear it, you know, how it would be affected with the eight justices on the court right now.
I was going to ask you if the NCAA has been brought up into questioning at all on the death of Antonin Scalia. Do you think that is part of, I kid.
Yeah, I think it's harder, right? Because
there was nothing nefarious taking place between the NCAA and that ranch in West Texas.
Yeah, I don't think so. But it's like so many issues. You can see how Scalia's death would impact it, because you have the liberal justices would go one way and the conservative justices would go the other way.
Yeah.
I don't know if college sports is as simple as that. You know, you have the free market arguments, and you have, you know, antitrust arguments. There's a lot of different legal layers here, and so I don't know how Scalia's death, or sort of, you know, you can usually sort of, you know, point to, you know, Sotomayor and say she'll, you know, be on this side of an issue, and Stevens will be, you know, on the, you know, this side of an issue. I'm sorry, Kennedy will be on this side of an issue. I don't know if, like, this issue breaks down as simply or is as easy to peg a justice on one side. And, of course, because there's eight justices, I think what happens is that if they split 8-8 or if they split 4-4, then they just revert to the ruling of the appellate court. And so
nothing changes.
And so nothing changes. And so we'll have to see. But if the NCAA appeals to the Supreme Court, we know that they're not happy that they're subject to these antitrust rules. And even though practically they have sort of maintained the status quo, they are concerned, you know, deeply concerned about what the future might be, you know, in terms of more antitrust cases.
I just like thinking that there is some sort of controversy involved with the NCAA and the death of Justice Scalia. I think that could really be what brings the institution down finally.
Mark Emmert was at that Texas ranch, and they scuttled him off in the dead of night as soon as Scalia didn't wake up.
You can't be here. You have to leave now.
They can't know that they're together.
A couple more things before I let you go. Do you think that in our lifetime we will see a players union like the one that was close to forming with the Northwestern football players, or was what happened there with Kane Coulter and Northwestern kind of, I want to say, how everyone is kind of secure with the status quo, but you certainly got the sense from like a football coach like Pat Fitzgerald, who's incredibly popular, you know, we think of as progressive at a school like Northwestern, and yet he himself was saying things like, you know, don't rock the boat, the system's fine the way it is type things. So if it's not going to happen at Northwestern, is a players union going to happen anytime soon anywhere?
I think the idea of like a national players union, sort of like the NFLPA or the NBAPA, is a little far-fetched because of just the way labor law is structured in different states. And so some states are right to work, and some states are, you know, card check. And so, and public employee unions, there are a number of states that don't even allow them. And so, you know, Alabama is a public school, so the football team would be a public sector union, and Alabama doesn't allow that. And so how you sort of negotiate labor law in different states is kind of hard. I do think at some point there will be a body that negotiates on behalf of players, however that might work. And sort of you ask, in our lifetime, what's going to bring change and you know, this representative change, you know, economic change, is we've seen how hard it is to go through the courts, right? The judge in the O'Bannon case, you know, gave these trust funds, and then they were overturned on appeal. And then in the Northwestern Union case, they won their case at the local level, and then the Federal Labor Board wouldn't even hear the case, refused to exert jurisdiction, which basically overturned, you know, the lower body's ruling. And people are so afraid to hit the eject button on this system because, you know, just like you have today, there are a lot of questions. You know, what would this mean? How would it work? And it touches a lot of aspects of society. This is higher education. You know, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of college athletes on campus. It's really part of the fabric of America. And so no judge wants to be the person who, you know, destroyed college sports, you know, for lack of a better explanation. But if you look at what happened at the University of Missouri just last year, there were issues of racism on campus. They had been percolating for weeks, months. And as soon as the football team stood up and said, we're not going to play on Saturday, the university president resigned in 36 hours. And that's how much power the players had, because there's so much money tied up in these games getting played with the TV contracts now. And so if you have a team that didn't come out for the Final Four one year, you know, the system would change in half an hour. And I think that's the route to change. And I think consciousness is growing amongst players. And we wrote in the book the story of the 1991 UNLV basketball team, which had plans to transfer but strike and sit out, boycott the 1991 NCAA championship game. And what happened is they lost in the Final Four to Duke. And so they never got to carry out their plan. But I think if they had struck, or if they had, you know, boycotted the game, college sports would look a lot different today than it does.
One of my absolute favorite basketball teams of all time. I wonder how that would have shaped my idea of college sports when I was just a kid growing up watching them play basketball. And last question before I let you go, Ben. If Trump University were a university that had student athletes with the system that you are describing, where there are salary caps, do you think there would be anything that would say that Trump University would not be perhaps become the most powerful organization in college sports, where they could afford the highest salaries of all institutions in the country?
Yeah, they might, you know, offer the players salaries, but if you look at Trump's record, you know, it probably looks like that the players wouldn't get the money, and they'd have to sue Trump University to get the money that they were promised.
But he
so
doesn't.
I don't know. There might be one good recruiting class, but I don't know how many good ones would come after that, because it certainly sounds like, you know, Trump would make them sue to get paid.
Yeah, but he doesn't settle.
Right, he doesn't settle. But you'd have years of litigation before the next recruiting class would go to Trump University, because they have no idea if they get paid.
Well, look, I can't promise you players any money, but I can offer you these fantastic steaks.
These fantastic steaks and a great hat. Make America great again.
Make America great again without the NCAA.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben, I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Yeah, enjoy it.
That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. You can download this and all past and future episodes of the Passport Play Podcast on iTunes or by visiting my website, passportplay.tumblr.com. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon.